this is Jenny Vrentis. I'm here with Connor Orr for this week's edition of the Weekside Podcast. Connor, I think we're going to start off today with a little bit with the tanking Dolphins.
Yes.
Who are now 0-4. Prospects for the season are essentially what we expected them to be.
Grim.
A little grim, yeah. You know, it's interesting that in Stephen Ross, in setting this team on this path last December, someone in the local media had asked him if he was ready for the team to go 3-13. And at that point, he said, well, I would hope we don't go 3-13. But clearly, that would be a generous projection at this point in time. I think they've bottomed out even a little bit more than perhaps even the Dolphins expected when Flores was hired. They've admitted they weren't planning to trade Tunsil, but the Texans kept coming after them with more. They certainly didn't plan on Minkah Fitzpatrick forcing his way out of town. So there's definitely evidence to suggest that this is even more of an extreme rebuild for Brian Flores than he probably thought when taking the job. But the idea of clearing the books, accumulating draft capital, that was always the strategy for this year. The question, I think, is, will it work? Can this work in the NFL? We've seen it work in other sports. Astros and the Cubs have championships. The Sixers do not, but are favored for a championship, or one of the favorites for a championship in 2020. But we don't have a real proof of concept in the NFL. I wrote a story about this this week, and that's sort of the question that we try to dive into. The NFL is different from the NBA, different from MLB for a lot of reasons. Roster size, the physical nature of the game, the fact that there's only 16 games. It's harder to do this in the NFL than in other sports. And while some see the Browns as a proof of concept for tanking, we still don't know if that will yield a championship team. They haven't yet had a winning record at any point in a season since 2014. So we don't know if they'll come out on the other side of this. I think one of the most interesting points that came out of the story was the danger that if you go too far, even if you bring in more players the following year, it can't help. I think we can all agree that it does make sense to reset the books. That $55 million of dead money on the cap this year, they were never going to have a chance to win this year. And so you can consider this a wasted year, but sort of a reset, like a flush for the organization, like a juice cleanse or something. But the question is, then when you try to start the rebuilding process, are you able to do that? And Jimmy Johnson, former Dolphins coach who spoke to the Dolphins at the beginning of this year, brought up that point in our conversation that you risk, when you're losing as badly as the Dolphins have been losing and by as wide of a margin, you risk the idea that even if you do bring in better players the following year, you've created this culture where players develop bad habits. They don't think they have a chance to win, so they don't do the extra work, that even bringing in those better players doesn't help. So I think that's the biggest question for the Dolphins. Will the pain be worth it? We know this year is going to be painful for the Dolphins, but from this point on, it's sort of a binary proposition. They either prove the concept in the NFL or they become another cautionary tale.
I was very excited about this episode in particular because I knew that you've been working on this story for a little while, and I wanted to talk much more about tanking in our first few weeks of the podcast, but I wanted to wait until this came out, so I'm excited. So I'm gonna, like, can I, like, interview you a little bit about this?
Sure, because Connor.
It's very good. Like, okay, so it's in the magazine this week, so anyone who is on a newsstand, pick it up. It's online. It published today, the day that we're recording this podcast, on Tuesday. So
the online version has a little bit more in it.
Yes.
You know, less space constrictions.
Yes. So, but buy the magazine because it's pretty to look at. Read it online too. Patronize the magazine, right? Is that the
word?
Patronize.
Great, yeah, great word.
Yeah, yeah. So, I thought you you talked to a lot of really interesting people around the concept of tanking. Joe Thomas, I thought, was a really interesting voice there because just a really a player who has seen a lot throughout his years, but then towards the end of his career, actually ended it with sort of a full scale tanking. What was his sort of thought on this?
Yeah, he ended with that 1-31 stretch, and while he does think it was worth it in the sense for the Browns now having Baker Mayfield and Myles Garrett and being able to use some of that draft capital to also trade for veteran players like Odell Beckham, he said the big miscalculation when the plan was presented was just how painful it would be. And the fact that there are only 16 games, and in the NFL, as compared to MLB or NBA, it's so much more painful both literally and physically or figuratively to lose. He made the point, you know, in baseball, you just play again the next night. In basketball, it's fine. You just run up and down the court and you get blown out. But there is a physical toll in football. And he thought a lot about especially linebackers like Christian Kirksey, who by virtue of the team having a bad offense, were on the field a disproportionate amount that season, which by the end of the year accumulates into a couple extra games for a defensive player. And if you're a linebacker, the other team is running the ball over 30 times a game, you know, just or probably more, you know, to run out the clock in the second half. And you just, it's like a battering ram. You just take a beating that really adds up over time. And I thought that was an interesting perspective to have, because even after one of the Dolphins game, I talked to Jerome Baker, who had had 12 tackles or something in the loss to the Patriots. They'd been on the field more than 36 minutes. And he was like, you know, recovery begins today, which for a lot of players is probably true. But in this game particularly, given the amount of time that he was asked to be on the field, I thought that was a good point that Thomas raised, that because of the pain, it was impossible for the head coach and the GM to still be there.
Right.
And most of the roster has also turned over. So it was so painful that really Jimmy Haslam and Paul DePodesta are the only two left standing, not the only two, but the two most prominent people left standing from that period.
So another thing that I think, if you're a Dolphins fan and you're reading this story and you've got a, I don't know, I guess a rosier view of the tanking process, one of the data-backed things that I think would scare me a little bit, too, is what the professor from, am I getting this right, Stonehill College. Stonehill College, who actually did a paper on this, right?
Yeah.
And, like, I think the conclusion there is kind of grim, right, for Dolphins fans. It's not just the accumulation of the picks. It's, like, it's doing something with them.
Yeah, that, in their study, which spanned, I think, 19 years in the NBA, they looked at, does having more picks and higher picks lead to an improvement benefit for the team over a four-year period? So they picked 4 years because that would be the period of time for rookie contracts. So was there an improvement in the win-loss record? And they found that having more picks and having higher picks did not correlate to an improvement over that period. But what there was a correlation with was or certain organizations and certain general managers who were better pickers and had a history of getting the right players and developing them. And, you know, so it really emphasizes the fact that no matter where you're picking in the round, you can have success. You just, you know, have to try to, obviously the goal of having more picks is having more chances to be right. And we do know that in the NFL, it is a little bit of a gamble. Probably more so than in the NBA. But the point was an interesting one, that there's so many things that go into making a player successful. And the teams that were picking at the top of the round and that had more picks, that wasn't enough to overcome the organizational deficiencies that led them having a bad record in the first place, was really his bigger point, I think, is that even when you're picking later in the round, if you have a good organization that has an eye for certain things, but also will work on developing the player and can augment the roster in other ways and can have a better roster around the players that helps them develop, all of those things, because of that, those organizations work and those general managers were correlated with a bigger success.
And it's scary too. I mean, you think about the beginning of the Sashi Brown Browns, and you know they accumulated a lot of picks, and they're not even on the teams anymore. And this was two years ago. Corey Coleman, you know, a lot of those high first and second round picks aren't even around anymore. It's just kind of scary. But the favorite kind of part that kind of gave me chills, obviously, is the end of the story. Christian Wilkins, their first round pick, and you know he's talking about keeping perspective and, you know, I get paid to do this job, so I got to give it all I got whenever I'm out there. You know, and if somebody, this is the end of the quote that really gets me. If somebody else is worrying about the future, I have to focus on now. Hopefully, I am there in the future.
Baker. Actually, that quote was Baker.
Okay.
But
yes,
but still, right. Same idea.
Wow. Like, you know, just thinking about being a player in that locker room. And it's just almost like I've compared it to, you feel like paving stone, right? You're just something to be run over for a future, you know? And it's just like, what that must feel like has to be just shocking to me. You
yeah,
know?
But you're right. The lead up to the quote was also Christian Wilkins saying, I have to keep my spirits up. So here's a guy who waited his whole life for this chance and went to Clemson and barely lost any games.
Yeah.
And now it's like, I'm keeping my spirits up because I love football, but he has to wonder what he's seeing in his early NFL career. And then across the locker room, Jerome Baker, you know, the guy we mentioned with having, you know, recovery starting immediately is sitting in his locker stall still. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think there is some awareness as a player in the NFL that that's always the case. You don't know how much longer you'll be anywhere or in the league at all. So I do think that's something that they learn to live with and that they accept as part of the reality of the profession that they're in. But especially this year, when you just see guys that you just lined up with, you know, he said that the, you know, during the last day that Minkah Fitzpatrick played in a Dolphins uniform, 17 months after the team drafted him in the first round. So there has been unprecedented turnover. And I think the ways in which the Dolphins roster is constructed similarly to the Browns roster, that Browns roster in the first year of tanking actually had a few more rookies, but they're both young, heavily reliant on young players with some veterans that are either being paid more or have a better opportunity in Miami. But I think where the Dolphins is a little bit more extreme is just the in season or right before the season trades, the loss of Tunsil and Minkah Fitzpatrick really rocked the locker room. Mm-hmm. And basically, I think it's hard to go on after that when you see players being shipped out. And you have to, because physically it's a risk to not give your all when you're on the field. But I do think it takes a lot more to hype yourself up into the mental state that you have to play this game when you see the roster being dismantled in real time.
Think about that. Just try to correlate that, you know, to any other business or any other walk of life, right? So we're at some sort of tech company, right? That, you know, we want to show massive losses because we want to be bought and split into pieces or whatever. Like, you know, we're at a, you know, and this is just a fictional example, but like, what if, you know, Sports Illustrated, we want to not have anybody read the website so we could get, you know, something bad could happen and then we could get better. Just the defeatist attitude that would probably creep into your everyday life. Like, even if, you know, we're at Dunkin' Donuts and we want to be split off from main Dunkin' Donuts, so we have to not sell any coffee for a month. It would be terrible to work at that Dunkin' Donuts. And it would be, you know, I just don't understand, you know, that is so much pressure on a head coach to be able to go in there every day and say, hey, you're doing something important, even though it really doesn't feel like it right now.
Right. And being in the journalism industry for the last decade, we have some sense of the doom and gloom of all of these changes happening around you. But this is, to your point, another level, because it's essentially saying you don't, the organization around you really prefers that you don't succeed. You don't have the support. That doesn't mean on Sunday the players and coaches aren't trying to win, because they are. Yeah. But the organization is not doing everything they can to field a winner. So you feel, you don't even have that certainty that everyone in your workplace wants this team to win, because in reality they would prefer that they don't.
As someone prone to a lot of conspiracy theories already, I can only imagine what it would be like to play for the Dolphins. I would be jettisoned from that team. I would not be allowed to be in that locker
room. You would speak out in the locker room. Yeah. The coach would call you in and say, or you're not on board with my vision, and you'd be shipped out.
Bring your playbook, or...
I could see it playing out.
All right. Well, we got a lot of good news topics to get to this week. This was another like crazy week in the NFL. I feel like there has been no sort of just settling down into a groove yet. I don't feel like there's been that week yet where it's like, okay, this is just a normal, boring week of football. But yeah, the Giants now are 2-0 since moving on from the Manning cabal and handing the reins to Danny Dimes. They had wins over the progressively inept Buccaneers and Washington football team, which begs the question, is Daniel Jones great, or is he just simply better than Eli Manning?
You wrote very smartly on this over the weekend.
I don't know about if the smartly is the right answer.
No, but I think you should.
I think it was on brand for me to be a wet blanket for Giants fans after a game like that, right? Because he threw one touchdown and two very bad interceptions. I mean, these were very rookie interceptions, you know. But to me, it just seems like even, and we touched on this a little bit last week, but just even the fact that he's able to escape certain things, just a little bit of that functional mobility makes the offense so much better just by comparison, that this feels like a breath of, like everything feels like a breath of fresh air. And I'm wondering when we are going to find out in a vacuum how good Daniel Jones is, because there's so much Eli Manning to compare it to, right? Especially right. Over the last two or three years.
Right. Yeah. And I think we all sort of, with the Bucs game, were aware of the fact that the celebration was premature, and there always is with rookie quarterbacks bumps in the road or regression back, you know. So I see your point. I'm still excited about Daniel Jones.
Yeah, I'm very excited about Daniel Jones. My fear is that we ride this high and then we end up there's an inevitability to it, that there's like an anchor tying us down, you know.
Okay.
But maybe not.
Maybe not, because I think in the New York market he's going to get brought back down to earth as much as he'll get praised. I mean, I went to Pat Shurmur's press conference last week on Wednesday after the Buccaneers starts, and one of the questions was essentially, is Daniel Jones feeling himself? Like, is he getting a little froggy? And Shurmur replied, like, he's like, are you asking me? I think his quote was, are you asking me if he has a big head or something along those lines, which is pretty hilarious. And of course the answer was no, it's everything, you know, he's taking everything in stride. I mean, this might be where the early jabs at him were actually a good thing. I mean, I could foresee us reading an article next summer about how the early criticism of the Giants pick really helps Daniel Jones keep his head down.
You know what this summer is, right? It's the summer of the Daniel Jones GQ tell-all. It's the summer of the clapback for Daniel Jones, right? If it's ever going to happen, this is the summer.
I feel confident that we're not going to be the target of that clapback, so I'm interested to read it.
Just sidle up poolside and enjoy a little tea.
But before we move on to the next topic, I just got to say, great use of cabal. One of my all-time favorite words. I remember when I was studying for like the SAT-2 subject specific in English or something, the book had told us that it was like the five ministers. I just looked this up to make sure that I wasn't making this up. The five ministers to Charles II, their names in an acronym were spelled cabal.
Really?
And that was where the word came from. However, online throws some cold water and says that this theory is not actually true. But that was what was taught to me by a SAT-2 prep book circa 2001. So their names were Clifford, Arlington, Buckingham, Ashley, and Lauderdale.
Really?
So I'm just going to go with it. Cabal.
You know what? We are at such a disadvantage because, you know, our SAT book said that Pluto is a planet, that too much red meat was bad for you, that, you know, all these things. And now we're finding out that it's fine, you know, or that it's not a planet. And, you know, we're just trying to survive. And we don't need all these foundational facts of our youth rattled by the internet.
Right. My very excellent mother just served us 9 pizzas is not really a mnemonic without pizza at the end.
Exactly.
Right.
Isn't Roy G. Biv, that's not true either, right? No, it's not.
Oh, like, God, all of these things. I didn't know this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like the rainbow's not the rainbow anymore either.
Good grief.
Had enough.
Yeah. All right. Moving on to topic 2. Speaking of having enough, Vontaze Burfict was suspended for the remainder of the season for his helmet-to-helmet hit on Jack Doyle in Sunday's Raiders win. There's already a groundswell of people suggesting Burfict may learn from this. He'll be off suspension at age 30. Will he ever play again? I did not see the groundswell of people suggesting.
I think it's just developing now.
It's just
like
developing.
Sort of the Burfict defense is forming right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think this suspension has the best chance of anything that we've seen till now of him never playing again, because the team can't count on the fact that he will be able to contribute to the team in a meaningful way. It should not have gotten to this point, obviously. I do not think he should have had the privilege to continue playing in the NFL, given his intentional pattern of dirty behavior at every turn, with really none of the deterrents to this point have worked. But he's continued to have been given opportunities, and as we've seen in the NFL, the only way that teams don't continue to give players opportunities if they think that they won't be available to them at some point in time. And so this, at least, he's going to miss the rest of the season. He'll appeal it, of course, but at this point in time, he's going to miss the rest of the season. So if you sign him next year, you know that whenever he makes the dirty hit, which will come at some point in time, that he'll then be out for the rest of the year.
I hope that this is sort of an unofficial expulsion, right?
Yeah.
Like, I hope that it serves as that, because, you know, it really, as a linebacker, it probably takes you out of your last year where teams are thinking that you could probably anchor a defense anyway. You're going to come back 30. You're going to be out of the game for mostly a year. I had thought, really, I mean, John Gruden is the last kind of person in the NFL that I feel like that's the last stop for someone like him anyway.
Or you
right?
mean the final person to give him a
chance.
Yeah,
the final. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like the Raiders, and I know that you touched on this in your Raiders piece a little bit too. I mean, there was such that effort to to conjure this toughness, this mythical, mm-hmm. like, oh, this is the way that the Oakland Raiders have always been, and we're the outcasts, and we're the misfits, and we wave a pirate flag, and this is how we, you know, and he was into that, right? I mean, there was an alert of that to him. And so, sure, Vontaze Burfict fits into that because he played like a player in the 70s, but that does not excuse the fact that all we've learned about player health and safety now, there's no place for him in the NFL. I don't think anyone suggesting anything differently that he's going to learn from this. Did you see the list of his infractions over the years that was floating around on Twitter?
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, there was like a dozen of these things, at least two a year, every year since he's been in the league.
Right.
And some of them just for an accumulation that they couldn't initially penalize him for.
Right.
Which is, it's crazy.
Yeah, you know? It took like a bit of time for it to get to critical mass, which it shouldn't have. I mean, we saw this behavior much earlier than this point in time. It's crazy, too, that he was a captain for the team. He was praised for pulling Antonio Brown back when he was going for Mike Mayock in that final Raiders confrontation. It's amazing to me that his image is anything other than intentionally being out to harm other players. That hit was so egregious because there was a clear effort. And he's lucky that he's never... that he hasn't physically reaped the ill wills of his on-field behavior personally.
Yeah.
That he's only dished it out. Because a lot of times it's the player that is making the offending hit that ends up with the brunt of the blow.
Yeah. I think, too, what was stunning to me is, and I get that maybe players don't have the luxury of thinking this way because they're in that bubble, but like we had just come off a Thursday night football game where two guys were carried off the field in stretchers. One, due to a really knucklehead hit by Derek Barnett from the Eagles, just a really egregious hit. How does that not seep in at some point, like the gravity of this? You know what I mean? Especially for someone like Vontaze Burfict, who has consistently been a cheap shot artist throughout his career. How do you not see that sometimes, you know, and just take that in for a second and think, man, like, you know, and I've seen this other player say this week, like, if we don't protect each other, who's going to, you know,
right.
But it's just crazy to me that someone would allow that to continue to happen.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a, looking back too, an enabling of the behavior in Cincinnati, a defense of it, rather than saying, you know, you see a lot of coaches walking the fine line pretty well, like Belichick did by saying with the hit in the Buffalo game, right, the Jonathan Jones hit on Josh Allen, he said essentially, if... We coached him to do it this way. If this is illegal, we'll have to coach him to do it differently. There's always that out for the coaches to just say it that way, to not blame the player, but then also acknowledge that there needs to be behavior correction. You can always take that approach.
Totally.
So they could have just said, hey, you know what? We're coaching Burfict this way, and we're going to change how we coach him. But there wasn't that.
What did he always say? He hits like a cement truck, and that's just the way Vontaze plays.
Right.
And then at some point, somebody's going to end up getting hurt. And I feel like that you're responsible for that.
Right.
Because you make a great point. You look at Bill Belichick, but then look at who's on the total polar left end of this is Pete Carroll. I'll bring in rugby guys, and I'll teach them how to tackle. This is the baddest defense of our generation that relearned how to tackle from rugby people to keep everybody safe. Why can't everybody else do it?
Right,
you know?
The hawk tackle
the
in
hawk
Seattle.
Tackle.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Why can't everyone just hawk tackle? That's that's my thing.
I agree, Connor. I'm with you.
Gotta get cooling down here. All right, so the Bills narrowly avoided a win against the juggernaut Patriots on Sunday, leaving both teams at an interesting crossroads here. I know we talked about the Bills last week on the podcast, whether we had been bought in on that 3-0 mark before this game. So does this change the way that you think about either of the teams? So are you less meh on the Bills, or are you thinking that the Patriots are more beatable than they previously were?
It doesn't change my view on the Patriots at all, because they generally don't get off to a good start in September. There's always one of these games, it seems. The last time they went 4-0 in September was 2015, which doesn't include their recent Super Bowl championships.
Yeah.
Or that was a year when they didn't win the Super Bowl, right? So I always expect them to have some kind of lapse in September, and it feels like that's always been their test month. They're still trying to put all the pieces together. They have so much roster movement. They always manage to figure things out, but September is always a month when they're trying to figure out how to make things work. And I think so we finally saw that game from the offense, right? They don't have Gronk. You know, they thought Brown was going to be here. He's as an additional boost for their offense. Obviously, he's not. And so I think we sort of saw that kind of game where everything didn't look like it had come together completely. But I'm used to seeing that from them early on. They've got the defense to pick things up, obviously, or to you know, pick up the team rather. But it does change my opinion on the Bills a little bit.
For sure. I think so, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was a tough performance, especially that defense, you know? I think that their game plan was smart. I think the way that they approached the Patriots. I mean, it's hard to think of fresh ideas after all this time, you know? I mean, a lot of defensive coordinators at that point probably just throw their hands up at some point. But I thought this was a fresh take on it. I thought that the running game is good. And you know what really I liked about this? A little bit of spice pregame.
Yes.
Sean McDermott kicking the Patriots staffers off the field saying, you guys aren't supposed to be here. I loved that.
I loved that too. I feel like you've got to have that edge if you're going to play the Patriots in division.
Yes. And you know what? It's not even about, I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, well, these people were up to something. But you know what? It's just got to feel good to say, hey, get off my field, and then play them tight like that. I think that was good. Good for Sean McDermott. Good
Did you catch that clip post-game, though, of Belichick running down Micah Hyde?
No.
Yeah, it was good, and I wish I had the TV station to credit. Okay, Channel 25 in Boston, here it is, got post-game video of this. Belichick runs after Micah Hyde, and he goes, did you get that interception? He had the pick of Brady, and Hyde goes, yeah, he was staring him down.
Wow.
I mean, that was pretty, for a couple reasons, you know, Bill's getting a little information from the opponent after the fact about what he saw. Also, like, laying the foundation for potentially recruiting him to join. I mean, it was kind of a stunning moment. It was great that they captured it on camera.
If you're a coach in general, knowing what you know about the Patriots, I know how I would treat it. Like if I'm a brand new head coach, and I know Sean McDermott's been in the league for as a head coach for a little while, and he's obviously been around the league for longer. But if I'm a first time head coach and I'm playing the Patriots, do you just let it kind of hit you like a tidal wave, or are you up on everything? You saying, why is he talking to this person? Mm-hmm. Why is he over there? How would you approach that? I don't know. I'm a pacifist. I would probably just let them beat me by 40 and just get out.
No, you wouldn't let them beat you by 40, but you might not. I think we have a similar personality type that we feel like if we poked the bear, we would regret it later. Yeah. We would probably actively choose not to poke the bear.
Yeah. But, you know, he's poking the bear. I think that's good.
Yeah. McDermott definitely poked the bear.
I think it was in a good, it's in a good way, right? I think there are good ways to poke the bear.
Yeah, I thought that was a good way. I agreed. I liked what he did. I do wonder what he'll say to Hyde about engaging in the Belichick information gathering post game.
Like, gotta shut that down.
Gotta shut that down, yeah.
Because he will come in. Just ask Stephen Gilmore.
That's right.
All right, what do we got here for number four?
Amid a full-scale meltdown against the Giants on Sunday, the Washington football team hastily inserted Dwayne Haskins and watched as he went 9 of 17 for 103 yards and 3 picks. Yes, it was that bad. Jay Gruden seemed previously unwilling to throw his rookie starter into the fray. Is this a sign of trouble in the nation's capital?
One of many signs of trouble in the nation's capital.
You know, just, yeah, right.
A little editorializing.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot going on.
To me, this was him throwing his hands up and saying, screw it then. Okay, here, you want him? There he is, you know?
Right.
Because there were lengthy sort of, not battles, because I do feel like Jay Gruden's handled this relatively well, given how crappy of a place he's in Washington. But the calls for Dwayne Haskins to start and people saying he's better than Case Keenum, I felt like this was just him saying, you know what? Go ahead. You think this is the answer? Here you go. Watch what happens. He's not ready. I've been telling you he's not ready. Go see that he's not ready.
It certainly did not seem like this had been the plan, that they had planned to insert him this early. I mean, even that Wednesday before the game, Gruden was saying he just needs a little bit more time, which is interesting because the knock pre-draft was, or during the draft, was that Haskins was so much better than Jones, and how could the Giants have taken Jones at 6 when Haskins lasted all the way to 15, and here Jones was already in the game performing well. So Gruden faced those questions this week, obviously, with the team squaring off, and he just made it seem like he needed more experience and he was going to wait, and ultimately that would have been the right decision.
This team feels to me like they're on the precipice of something very bad. Like they're like 0-4 is bad, obviously, but that the we're not looking at them the same way that we're thinking about maybe the Dolphins mm-hmm. with a brighter prospect on the future, mm-hmm. right? It's like this is a team that's not trying to tank, but has the same record and has zero of the upside, I feel like.
Right, because they drafted a quarterback this year. Yeah. So unlike the Dolphins, they're not writing off this year. They're not actively writing off this year. They didn't go into this basically planning that this was going to be a year when they reset the books and when they flushed everything out to set up for a fresh start next year. They took the quarterback they liked. They thought they were, you know, but it's also different because Brian Flores is in his first year mm-hmm. and Jay Gruden has been there for a long time.
Yeah. You hate to say, and I've always said this, I hate predicting coaching vacancies in September and October. I don't think that's fair to anybody, but this feels like one of the ones that has been inevitable since mm-hmm. before the season. And it's like, you just wonder from people from the outside looking in, like who's going to sign up for this? I mean, this right. just, it feels like this would be a rough go at it for someone who is trying to make a name for themselves in the NFL, trying to carve something out. I mean, that's got to be a tough job.
Right. And you often see this when a quarterback is drafted and a coach is on the hot seat going into the year. And there's that push and pull between who ultimately makes the decision about when the rookie starter plays. And is it in the coach's best interest to keep going with the veteran before putting in a rookie who's not ready? At the same time, the front office or the owner might want the rookie in there. And so I think ultimately it's not too big of a projection to wonder, you know, if that happened in this case or where the pressure was coming from.
And really, you know, what I wanted to write, what I didn't end up kind of being able to get there is Dwayne Haskins is the one who suffers ultimately, right?
Right.
Because
totally.
You're in the middle of this thing and, you know, and I don't know what the answer is because it's hard, but it just really stinks for certain players who just get placed into this black hole, right? I mean, you know, you're the not in the middle of a tug of war between a coaching staff and ownership. Like, when has that ever worked out for anybody?
Right. Know? Yes, it does. Exactly. You're going to have some kind of change, and it's always rough for a rookie quarterback when they have a change in the coaching staff within the first year. It's really puts a wrinkle in their development, and it's hard to see things getting much better in Washington anytime soon.
Yeah. Speaking of places where it's hard to see things getting much better, this is a big week for me. This is, I've cleared my Sunday. For those of you who have listened to any of our MMQB podcasts in any form or have read anything that I've written over the last 2 years, 90% of which is about John Gruden, know how I feel about this situation. I felt like the Khalil Mack trade was idiocy. I feel like he's running this franchise into the ground. And rarely do we get a chance to see this manifested in a singular matchup, but we got the Bears and the Raiders in London. Khalil Mack's excited. I'm excited. Are you excited?
You sounded like a little John Gruden Monday Night Football-ish promo there, like a Khalil Mack's excited. I'm excited. These guys are going to be out there on
this
the field.
This guy here.
I don't know, Connor. It might be rubbing off on you a little bit. No, this is epic. I mean, when this was on the calendar, I mean, you just can't not get excited for it. That the Mack trade over a year later is still stunning.
Completely. You know, and it frustrates me because I have a place to stay out there. You know, my sister, who is a podcast listener, is now a London resident. She's officially full-time English. I could have stayed there, could have covered the game for free, really could have, you know, really dug in
really
on
dug
some
in.
Of the...
Yeah, the scene.
Yeah, just mm-hmm. written like 6,000 words on that, you know, just what that was like. But I don't know. I mean, what could happen? I mean, you know, this is a team that struggles to protect the quarterback, even though they do have a good offensive line. They've definitely revamped their offensive line. Chicago's defense looked excellent over mm-hmm. the weekend against Minnesota. I mean, just completely blanked them without a quarterback of their own. I don't know. This has a possibility. This is the one of those games that you just pointed to on the schedule at the beginning of the season and said, yes, this is it. I want to see this.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago's defense has not lost a beat since losing Vic Fangio, which was a concern. And Khalil still probably has a lot of feelings, even though I know he is not a very outspoken guy, but probably has a lot of feelings about what the heck happened. I mean, he planned to play his whole career with the Raiders. You know, his previous head coach, Jack Del Rio, was there. They were at a road game in Baltimore. Del Rio went outside in front, out front, took a photo of the Ray Lewis statue, came in, showed it to Mac, and said, "This will be you one day, you know, with the Raiders." Oh. And it's looking back, how did it ever get to that point? The narrative was shifted so much to putting the blame on the player, which I'm sure that he's happy he's in Chicago, right? He's at with a great defense. He has the potential. I mean, they made the playoffs last year. You know, they're a team that has the potential to do so again, right? Better situation in the short term than the Raiders, potentially the long term. I know Orr feels that way, and I think I do as well. But when you have your team basically putting it on you, I know holdouts got messy, but Gruden essentially said, oh, he wasn't returning my phone calls. And, well, you weren't offering him anywhere close to what he was worth.
Right.
You know that this is a good kid. He was, as somebody on the team put it, you know, if he sneezed, you'd have 52 players saying bless you, right? He's not an outspoken guy, but he was such a leader and set such an example in that locker room and also was humble. I mean, when he got there, he asked for his locker to be between Charles Woodson and Justin Tuck because he wanted to live or learn from both of them. And so you lose that presence in your locker room. And you can understand if they're a rebuilding team, that's their best asset. But it is, going back to what we were saying about the Dolphins, it is hard when you lose those locker room cornerstones that really bring up everybody in an intangible way.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you have to pay him a lot of money, but there is a worth that goes beyond to just the fact that he's one of the best players in the league, which a lot of places would say is enough of a reason to pay a generational pass rusher. There's also the fact that they're establishing this culture of hope, of doing the extra things to get better. And so I still have a hard time understanding. I know you have a prediction for how this game might go, which transitions into our next segment.
Yeah, so this is going to be a tough one. I will say, though, I mean, you know, Gruden was right about one thing. You know, trading Mac gave them the firepower to bring in guys like Antonio Brown. So, you know, really smart smart stuff on his part. So
Zing.
For my Oracle prediction this week, remember, my most recent pending prediction is that the Browns do shift offensive play callers at some point. That was a rough week. They put up a 40 burger on the Ravens. Freddie Kitchens looks like he's going to be okay. I will say a lot of those points came in garbage time. I do think that
important to note.
There still may be a sea change offensively there, but again, that prediction is in limbo, especially since I put a tight time frame on it. But my prediction this week is going to be an immediate gratification thing. We will know whether or not it's right or wrong the minute that the game ends. And I say that Khalil Mack will not get a sack against the Raiders on Sunday, and here's why. I think that John Gruden is maniacal enough and petty enough to sell out everything else in his offense to ensure that Khalil Mack does not get a sack at the risk of everybody else getting five or six. I think that there will be a sack party in London. People of London will enjoy all the sacks, but just no Mack sacks.
That's good. They'll put like three people on
yes,
them, right?
You know?
Double team, get another person out of the backfield,
exactly.
Chipping or something.
Yes. Yeah, I think it will be egregiously obvious to anyone
good. I like
watching
it.
The game that he will not want Khalil Mack to get a sack. You know what I would love to see, though, is that the one funny thing about Hard Knocks was watching John Gruden, like, you know, they're preparing for a preseason game or against the Jets or whatever it was, and he's like, yeah, this guy here, yeah, Le'Veon Bell, and like, you know, he's talking about Le'Veon Bell like maybe your dad would talk to you about like a good player from his era, and all the players are sitting in the room like, yeah, I know, like, he's good. And we got to tackle him. I mean, mm-hmm. So let's move on. But it was like this 20-minute monologue about just like all these great plays of his. And it's like, yeah, I get it. And I wonder what he will, what he would do for Khalil Mack, because that's the guy, right? You
right.
would highlight, obviously, pregame. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what do you say to your guys? Like, yeah, sorry, he could be here. We're 2-2. Might have helped us win one of these first few games, you know?
To be a fly on the wall for that meeting.
Yeah. I don't know. But let's end on a happy note, because here at the Weekside Podcast, we like to end on consensus. We are not a group of people that enjoys screaming at each other, just with each other, maybe, if that makes any sense. But I like ending the show on this segment every week, because Jenny gives us something that maybe we're not thinking about, that I think we can all agree on, or most of us can agree on. What's your consensus for this week?
Mitchell Trubisky unlikely to play. I say that Chase Daniel actually gives the Bears a better chance to win against the Raiders in London.
I think that you're saying something that a lot of people there don't want to say or admit to themselves. Mm-hmm. But I think there are people watching that game on Sunday when that happened saying, he looks pretty good and he's very accurate. And
yeah.
That's all that offense asks of you, right?
He's been in that offense for a very long time, mm-hmm. going back to Kansas City. What, 6 years, I think he's been in and around that scheme. He knows exactly. He's very comfortable. He's plays the role of point guard in that offense well. He knows exactly where he has to go with the ball and when. He's also been in the league for a while, but he's only really accrued 4 seasons of playing, essentially,
right,
because he's been a backup for so much of it. So age really isn't an issue. In fact, in his case, I think it just helps him be in terms of his knowledge. So I like the Bears in this game, even without their starting quarterback.
I think what they lose at all, I guess, in the mobility that you would say is a strength of Trubisky's, I think you gain in. Mm-hmm. Chase Daniel made some really nice throws on Sunday. I don't know. I agree with you. I think it's one of those things that maybe a lot of Bears fans too are like, I think so.
They're thinking but don't want to say.
Yeah, they just don't want to say it. But I don't know. I think it's going to be interesting. It's safe to say that all eyes from the Weak Side podcast will be on Bears and Raiders. A lot of juice at stake here. Thank you for listening this week, guys. And just so you know, the MMQB Weak Side podcast is me, Connor Orr, and Jenny Vrentis. We're produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive director of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is the director of editorial projects. And Mark Mravick is the executive director of the MMQB. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating, 5 stars. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.